This show is brought to you by Gobble by Kevin Carr, a Thanksgiving novelette of the zombie apocalypse, and you thought your family dinner was stressful. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. I'm going to be talking about the big release, which is Office Christmas Party. And in terms of the award films, I'm going to be talking about La La Land, Manchester by the Sea, Nocturnal Animals, Miss Sloan, and Jackie. So it's a full slate of movies this week. I'm also going to be talking about the news, the trailer park, box office predictions, and of course the home cinema roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. Or you can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
First thing, I just want to give a real quick plug once again to the Critics' Choice Movie Awards that are airing Sunday night, December 11th at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific on A&E, hosted by T.J. Miller. If you remember, I am a voting member of the Broadcast Film Critics Association, so I have cast my ballots, and none of them were for Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. You can check out whether the stuff I liked, if you've been following me throughout the year, the stuff I liked, whether it's going to win. So yeah, Sunday night, 8 o'clock on A&E, December 11th. The next piece of news I want to hit is Jimmy Kimmel, of all people, will be hosting the Oscars, which is as good of a reason as any to avoid watching any part of the Oscars. I've never liked Jimmy Kimmel. I didn't like him when he was fat and lazy on The Man Show. I don't like when he's trimmed down and has his own late night talk show. Next piece of news, Little Shop of Horrors is getting a redo. We're talking about the musical here. Originally, Little Shop of Horrors was this one of those disposable shot in one or two days movies by Roger Corman back in the 60s. Got a little bit of traction as a cult film. And then in the 80s, maybe it was late 70s or early 80s, that these people made an off-Broadway production of it as a musical. And it was a huge hit, and it took off. And then they made a movie out of it with Rick Moranis, and Bill Murray was in it, Steve Martin, directed by Frank Oz, and brilliant puppetry by Jim Henson's people to do the Audrey 2, the giant plant that eats people. I mean, I could see them making it as one of those broadcast musicals that they did with, like, Hairspray just this past week, or they did with Grease or Peter Pan or Sound of Music. But I don't know why they'd want to remake the movie, because it's already a period piece. It's not like you need to update the time setting unless you do make it updated, which kind of ruins the charm of it. And the effects were so good and convincing back then, you know it's going to be all CGI and it's going to look like garbage. Why don't they just make a new real version of the original Roger Corman movie and make it a straight up horror movie? I think that would be kind of cool. Do a Little Shop of Horrors, but do it as a serious, scary movie, as a monster movie about a plant that does come to life, but not in a goofy, sort of silly beatnik kind of way, which the original movie was. The last piece of news is I wanted to just point out that Disney, I've mentioned this before, Disney's had a banner year, and it has barreled past $6 million worldwide with its movies just about a month ago. And that's when all the movies total was like $10 billion for all studios. And Rogue One hasn't even come out yet. So Disney is having the best year of its existence on record. It's almost $2.5 billion domestically. That's not even including the international. And more than 25% greater than the next studio, which is Warner Brothers. And the only reason that worked out is because of Batman vs. Superman, Suicide Squad, and Fantastic Beasts. But here's the reason why Disney has worked so well now, is they are not doing everything under Disney. They've got acquired brands, Pixar, Marvel, Lucasfilm, all three of those. Those are the ones that are responsible for a good chunk of this money train. And then the other stuff is from the traditional animation stuff that's kind of morphed into the CGI, where you got Zootopia, you got Moana, you've got Jungle Book. Those are all big hits. But without Pixar, Marvel, and Lucasfilm, their numbers aren't as good. In fact, their traditional Disney banner releases, yeah, Pete's Dragon did well this year, but the two big flops were the BFG and Alice Through the Looking Glass. So what Disney has done is what it's always done, is it's acquired things and not homogenized them into a standard Disney template. They're allowing the brands to exist, which is why you can have movies like a Star Wars movie, which comes out next week, a Marvel movie that's been in theaters for about a month and a half, and their Disney animation movie, which just opened a couple weeks ago, all doing well. They're not competing with each other. It's a brilliant business move by Disney, just in sort of setting this all up. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. No, I'm not going to talk about Spider-Man Homecoming, mainly because it appeared on the Jimmy Kimmel Show. I just can't talk about him twice in one week because he's the worst thing to happen late night since Whoopi Goldberg and Pat Sajak got their own TV shows. Let's talk about 50 Shades Darker. The new trailer dropped this week. It's awful. Take a listen.
Take him off.
You're just going to stand there gawking?
Yes.
Your boyfriend has a reputation. Do you want to be kept? Or have respect.
Do you think you're the first woman to try to save him?
If something were to happen to you, I could never forgive myself.
Part of my big complaint about the original 50 Shades of Grey was there was no understanding of what actually any sort of this bondage lifestyle is. It presents it as something that needs to be fixed, which it's not. I mean, if you like tying somebody up or getting tied up and you got a partner who's willing to do that, go for it. What you do in your own red room is nobody's business. And if you've got a freak flag, let it fly and be happy about it and be part of it. They make this as part of him being damaged, which it's not. The other big problem with this movie is there's nothing scintillating. There's nothing taboo about this in the movie. And you hear it right at the beginning of the trailer. He's like, take him off. He's talking about her underwear. They're at dinner. He wants her to take off her underwear. And then he kind of grabs her in the elevator. This is not exactly edgy stuff. I mean, this was not the first person in the history of the universe to walk around without underwear on under a dress. This is the most white bread pablum that's being sold as, oh, sexy and daring. And it's not. It just appears boring like the rest of the movie looks. Good luck on Valentine's Day, guys. This will be a fun one. Opens on February 10th. The next one I want to talk about is Transformers: The Last Night, which opens on June 23rd. Oh, dear God, give this one a listen.
Optimus Prime has left us. 100 billion trillion planets in the cosmos.
You want to know, don't you? Why they keep coming here.
I want to stay. And I want to fight them.
Forgive me.
I'm going to quote David Bowman from 2010.
My God, it's full of
this thing looks terrible. And part of the problem is I can't discern any sort of plot to this. There's this narration by Anthony Hopkins who's like, oh, they've been here forever. Why do they stick around? I'm like, yeah, and explain to me why we're still around when they were as flying freaking mechanical dragons and we were in the Dark Ages. This makes it look like humanity actually had a shot against these guys back in the Bronze Age. And haven't we already answered this? Didn't they talk about them being on the moon forever in the third movie? What you get with this trailer is exactly what you'd expect. Lots of explosions, no coherent story suggested whatsoever. And to that point, I know the story of the first one, but Transformers 2, 3, and 4, I couldn't tell you a story if there was a gun to my head. He was supposed to be done with this after the third movie, and this is, oh, I'm going to do one more. It's been 10 years, man. Do something else. I mean, actually, your non-Transformers stuff maybe didn't make as much money, but was more interesting, at least. 13 hours in Pain and Gain. Oh, this just looks awful. And what's an interesting little side note is the last movie didn't do well. Domestically, it made like $240 million. They greenlit a budget of $260 for this one. And it's all because of the international market. So all of you out there who think foreign films and foreign audiences, oh, they like the highfalutin, more classy stuff. They don't. They're the reason we're getting more of the Transformers movies, or it would have been dead with the last one. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Nocturnal Animals and Miss Sloan. Stop it now. Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Stop it now.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr, rolling into the movie reviews, and I'm going to hit some of the arty-farty films, the more award-worthy movies, and these are always a challenge to cover at this time of year, because the way these releases go is they'll have limited rollouts, and they'll start off in New York and LA on their opening weekend. So when you see a poster for, like, Miss Sloan, which we'll be talking about here in a minute, and it says opening November 18th, it doesn't really open on November 18th where you are. It's in New York and LA, and that's it. And then they roll it out because they're hoping to get word of mouth and some buzz and critical nominations. There's no set schedule of when to cover these because this is a syndicated show. You hear it all over the nation, so you may not have this in your theaters, or it may have already come. Who knows? But I'm going to cover these and sort of do a mop-up as we approach the end of the year. So the first one I want to talk about is Nocturnal Animals. A high society art curator is contacted by her ex-husband, a writer, who sent her his latest manuscript, which hits close to home.
When you love someone, you have to be careful with it. You might never get it again.
My ex-husband used to call me a nocturnal animal.
I didn't know you had an ex-husband. Did you love him?
I did something horrible to him. I left him in a brutal way.
What are we gonna do?
It's a question of how serious you are about seeing justice done.
The setup is Amy Adams plays this woman, and she's an art curator. And she lives this very sterile, very trendy lifestyle, but she's not happy at all. You can tell she has everything you'd want materialistically, and she's full of fashion and looking very perfect. But you can tell there's something missing inside of her. And she gets contacted and starts reading this manuscript from her ex-husband, played by Jake Gyllenhaal. And sort of like there's a second story. So we have one, it's one of those movies within a movie, although it's a book within a movie. And it shows more of what her visceral relationship was with him. And even though it's not a true story, it's clear that it was inspired by herself and him. It was inspired by emotions of betrayal and grief that a lot of people go through. And she is drawn into the book, and the book becomes more real than her real life. It's a bit of a high concept story. I wasn't terribly interested in the wraparound story, so to speak. The story within the story, which is about a guy who's driving with his wife and daughter and they get kidnapped in the middle of nowhere, Texas. I was kind of intrigued by that, partly because I've driven those roads and it can be kind of scary when you are literally in the middle of nowhere. So I know what it's like and how scary it can be in that situation. And, you know, I've got kids and I've got a family and how emotional that part is. But then when we pull back into the real world, which is her very sterile, trendy existence, it's a little boring, and which I guess is kind of part of the problem with her life. The movie does win the award for the most arresting opening sequence. If you've seen it, you know what I'm talking about. It's getting a certain amount of traction, mainly because of Michael Shannon. And he's up for a Critics' Choice Movie Award this weekend as the Texas Ranger in the story within the story, trying to track down people who done him wrong, Jake Gyllenhaal's character. It's a well-made movie. It's a little hard to digest because you're trying to take these somewhat extreme and disparate characters and sort of digest them into your own reality and how it meshes with things in your own life. But overall, Nocturnal Animals, I think, is a good movie. It's worth seeing. It's interesting, and it's different than a lot of what you're going to see out there. So I'm going to have to say Nocturnal Animals kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Miss Sloane. Jessica Chastain plays a heavy hitter in the dark underbelly of lobbying, the politics behind politics. She joins a new firm to influence gun control legislation and possibly goes in too deep and too far.
You want to lead the fight on gun control?
There's over 5 million of us, and we're armed.
Start an inquisition.
They will throw you in jail for contempt of Congress!
We have to make it personal.
You know the word annihilate? It means reduced to nothing.
This is more important than my career.
It was mind-boggling.
You crossed the line.
Ingenious.
Bugging and tapping. And
completely unbelievable.
I'm just going to start this off by saying, and if you've listened to the show long enough, you know my feelings on Jessica Chastain. I'm not impressed with her as an actress. I really am not. And Amy Adams in Nocturnal Animals, I think, is a much more compelling on-screen character. Jessica Chastain, there are people who absolutely love her. But I have to say, there's very few movies I've seen her in that I've either found her A, convincing, or B, compelling. I just find her irritating. And the more hardcore and set in stone and strong-willed she is in these movies, the less convincing I find her. If you saw Zero Dark Thirty, which is an okay movie, there's a scene in there where she's in a boardroom meeting trying to convince people of, because they're trying to hunt down Osama bin Laden, and she's trying to convince people of something, and she drops the F-bomb. And it is the most ridiculous scene ever because she is so unconvincing dropping the F-bomb. She tries to drop it like Samuel L. Jackson would, and she ends up dropping it like Morgan Freeman did in Wanted. It just sort of flops out there, and it's like a kid putting on their parents' clothes and playing dress up. She just isn't convincing as hardcore B-word, we'll say. I just don't find her all that interesting. And that's my biggest problem with Mrs. Sloane. Every time she was on screen, I'm just like, ugh. She's trying, but it just feels like she's trying as opposed to actually acting and achieving it. And I know that I'm in the minority. I know there's a lot of people out there like Jessica Chastain, but this movie just, and you can hear it even in the voiceover in the trailer. She just sounds bored. Now, in the movie itself, I like movies about politics, and I like movies about sort of like that inner working behind the scenes, but this reminds me a little bit of that movie Equity with Anna Gunn that came out earlier this year, where it's trying to show the reverse side of the gender card and trying to show the woman in the traditional male role of manipulative SOB. And she doesn't carry it off very well. Part of the other problem with this is politics gets in the way because this becomes about gun control. And I'm like, oh, because that's like having a movie about abortion. You're just like, oh, God, you know, you're going to no matter where you are on the issue, you're going to polarize your audience. And then the movie's going to become an issue movie. This movie isn't even about gun control, but anybody who has an opinion on gun control, which is like everybody, regardless of what the opinion is, you're going to be like either, oh, that's BS, or oh, they're the good guys. It's just, the second it became about gun control, I lost interest because I'm like, well, now it's going to be an argument about gun control as opposed to showing just how seamy and sleazy both sides are in the sort of political lobbying world. But then you're suddenly supposed to root for her. And I couldn't root for her. I didn't find her interesting or compelling or likable, even in the extreme. The bad guys were more likable to me. So I'm going to have to say Miss Sloane kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the raucous office Christmas party in Manchester by the Sea.
For
Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about a not award film. Let's talk about Office Christmas Party. We're going to continue to roll through the reviews, but let's pull back from the award stuff and talk about the one wide release, but it's getting lost in this sea of award films. But fortunately, there's something to it that can allow it to break out and at least be seen as something different than the standard award fare. A Chicago business that is set to be downsized at the end of the year throws one last raucous party before the axe falls.
This branch is failing. I'm shutting you down.
You gotta give us a little bit of time to turn this around.
All right. If by some miracle you can close Walter Davis and his $14 million account, your jobs are safe.
Done. Guys, what if we show him the greatest time of his life at our Christmas party tonight? This is how we save everybody's job.
It's not the worst idea.
Walter, do you party?
I used to.
Light the candle.
Merry Christmas! Right down the chimney, folks! Yeah!
Greatest party ever.
I kid about this being the only release of the week, and it's lost in a sea of award films. But that does bode well for a movie like this, at least for me. I remember several years ago, it was like when Cursed came out, which was a werewolf movie by Wes Craven starring Christina Ricci. And one of the reasons I liked it as much as I did, even though it was the PG-13 neutered version of it that hit theaters, is it came out in February, right in the middle of the big Oscar push. And I mean, like I said, this was like 10, 11 years ago. But I remember when that happened, and I remember thinking, it was just nice to not have a significant movie. It's nice to have a movie that really has no redeeming value and doesn't have a real big emotional push, that it's just there to be sort of this exploitation movie. And that's kind of the way Office Christmas Party is. It has a story and it has a bit of a message about being good to your workers and being good to people you work with and fostering a good business environment. Yes, you can strip away a lot of stuff and glean that. But in the end, it's an all-night party movie. And that's what I liked about it. It was a great way to just detach, because I, as I mentioned, the Critics' Choice Movie Awards are coming up. Now, they're early this year. They're usually in January, but for whatever reason, they moved it back because of holiday schedule and when Christmas falls. They moved it back into December. So right at this time, I was watching a ton of award films, trying to see as many as I could before nominating and voting. So I'm here watching movies like The Handmaiden, which is Park Chan-wook's lavish movie about betrayal and love in Korea. And then I'm watching movies like Love and Friendship, which is a Jane Austen story with Kate Beckinsale. And then in the midst of all this, I'm watching Office Christmas Party. And that's, I think, probably one of the reasons I kind of liked it more than I would have otherwise. If this had been just an August release, I probably would have rolled my eyes at it. But for me, I was like, oh yeah, I can get behind this movie simply because it's not a stuffy award film. And it's funny. I mean, there's some stuff that's not funny. There's some stuff that doesn't stick in the landing. But overall, it's a nice diversion for me. I know people who hated it, but I'm like, you're expecting too much from a movie like this. I like Jason Bateman. Don't particularly like him in the stuff he directs himself, because I think he's a little too sardonic to drive the whole thing. But I think he's still great as a lead actor. And Jennifer Aniston in here. Let me just say, I like it when Jennifer Aniston plays the bad guy. Movies like Horrible Bosses 1 and 2, I thought she was fantastic in. I mean, like, not just good, but fantastic. Or a movie like We're the Millers, which came out 3-4 years ago. And even though she was sort of the hero in it, she was a good guy, she was still that very edgy person. And I thought that was way funnier than just another iteration of her Rachel character that she never could get traction on in movies in the 90s. I think she works better as an edgy character, as a sharp-witted comedian, because she is good at that. And T.J. Miller's in this, and he's very funny. Olivia Munn is surprisingly game in the movie. I've never been a huge Olivia Munn fan, but I think she comes across as very likable in this movie. Kate McKinnon's in it, farting once again. I think she farts in every movie that she's been in this year, which is fine. I mean, you know, hey, you know, women fart too. We know that. But, she does kind of retread the character you saw, few people saw in Mastermind. So the fact that she's playing the same character is okay because nobody saw that movie. Overall, this is funny. It's stupid and it has no redeeming value, but every now and then you need a movie that has no redeeming value. And so for me, I'm giving the vote for no redeeming value to Office Christmas Party as saying it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Manchester by the Sea. Casey Affleck plays a handyman who is thrust into responsibility when he is named guardian of his nephew after the unexpected death of his brother.
Hello, this is Lee.
What happened to my brother?
So that's Lee Lee Chandler.
I don't understand.
Which part are you having trouble with?
Well, I can't be his guardian.
Well, your brother provided for your nephew's upkeep. I think the idea was that you would relocate.
Relocate to where?
Well, if you look, it was my impression that you'd spent a lot of time here.
I'm just a backup.
If you see this movie for no other reason, you should see it because of Casey Affleck's acting. He's really good in this. He's phenomenal in this movie. I really think he has a chance of winning an Oscar for this role. It's a high-profile enough movie that people are aware of it. He's already got nominations. He's nominated for a Critics' Choice Movie Award. He does a great job in it, and it's a very, at times, heartbreaking film. Now, when it comes to Casey Affleck, he's always kind of been in his big brother Ben's shadow. You know, Ben Affleck came on the scene so big in the late 90s, and Casey Affleck just is kind of like on his coattails. And even though Casey Affleck has had some serious acting roles, not the least of which was Gone Girl, directed by his brother, he's always been sidelined as, he's just that goofy kid from Good Will Hunting. And I think he's got some serious acting chops. He certainly shows them here. And he's very vulnerable. If there's anything about his character, he can play pathetic and vulnerable and, but do it in a realistic, not, unappealing way. There's also good performances by Michelle Williams, who plays his ex-wife, and they have a history there. This is one of those intimate looks at families, and it's a little more real. Now, I loved The Hollers, which came out earlier this year, which was a sort of that dysfunctional family movie. This one feels a little more dysfunctional, which makes it a little more real because you don't choose your family. And while you may, your own nuclear family, the people you live with, you may love living with them, you always have to go out and see other members of your family. And there's always going to be conflicts there. And this shows where there's tension and conflicts, especially when there's something really dark and horrible in their past. And it's a tearjerker. It's at times a tough movie to watch. It is very sad at times, but it also has some very funny moments, but it juggles some of these roles really well because you've got Affleck as the main character and it's juggling his having to face the responsibility of unexpectedly becoming the father of a teenager, but it also juggles the teenager, his nephew's life as well, which is of course in turmoil because his father passed away. And it shows how broken families mend and how broken families work with each other. And it shows how people, not just the direct family, but the extended family and the family of the community itself, deal with grief and tragedy, not always in the best way. So I'm going to have to say Manchester by the Sea, it's a surprisingly compelling movie, runs a little long. I will say it does take a while to end. But if for no other reason, you should see it for Casey Affleck's performance because he's going to be getting nominations throughout, you know, the Oscars. And I would not be surprised if not only gets nominated for an Oscar, but wins. He's really quite good in this movie. So I'm going to say that Manchester by the Sea rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
That's it for this segment. I'm going to go to a break. I got a couple more movies to talk about, which is La La Land and Jackie. I'm also going to be talking about the box office and, of course, the home cinema roundup. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies to wrap up the movie reviews. Now that we've talked about Office Christmas Party, let's dial it back. We already did it with Manchester by the Sea, but we're going to dial it back into award films. These are a little more recent, though, and they seem to have a bigger nationwide push, especially this first one I'm going to be talking about, and that is La La Land. An aspiring actress falls for an aspiring jazz musician in this musical love letter to Los Angeles.
Here's to the ones who dream foolish as they may seem. Here's to the hearts that ache. Here's to the mess we make.
One of the things that I find somewhat irritating about the entertainment industry in both New York and LA is there is such a fascination with themselves. They're very much into navel gazing. And there was a movie a couple years ago called They Came Together, and it stars Paul Rudd and Amy Poehler, and it's directed by David Wayne. And it has a great joke where they're like, we just wanted to make the city a character in the movie, which you hear all the time, and they overplay it. In the movie itself, they talk about the city being a character. And that's so true that you see people saying that about Los Angeles and New York in behind the scenes of movies, especially TV shows. If you're doing like a cop drama in New York, and they're like, oh, we wanted to make the location another character. No one says that when they have it take place in Hoboken, New Jersey. They say that when it's New York and LA, and there's such a narcissistic flavor to that. It's called La La Land, even though nobody in Los Angeles calls it La La Land. There is a certain amount of, oh, isn't it great being in Los Angeles? And not to dismiss Los Angeles, there's a lot of history there. And especially if you're into the arts, maybe not jazz club as much as acting. And this does give a very positive look at LA. But if you live in LA, that's just where you live. I'm pretty sure that the people in South Central aren't going, we live in La La Land. So there's a bit of a dishonesty and narcissism to this movie, just from the title alone, and it certainly shows it throughout the rest of the film. Now, it's also a love letter to old Hollywood, sort of like the way Rules Don't Apply was. This is about Hollywood now, but also Hollywood of the days gone by when you have musicals. And so they have these big production numbers on the street, and it does juxtapose the annoyances of modern LA, like traffic on the 405, with the big production numbers. So I think it does that really well, but it is very LA-centric. And it's a bit trite to have an actress and a musician fall in love. There's a lot that's fighting against a lot of things. But what makes it transcend that is the performances by Emma Stone in particular, but also by Ryan Gosling as the couple, the people who fall in love. It also has some pretty good music. It has some wonderful songs. You heard that one in the trailer by Emma Stone. And it is a charming movie in spite of it being the LA gear shoes of cinema, where Angelinos maybe aren't as fascinated with it as people who aren't in Los Angeles. Well, like one of the things they sent us, the studio sent us this big coffee table book of Los Angeles. And I don't know anyone in Los Angeles who would have that coffee table book. It's just, that's where you live. You know, I live in Columbus, Ohio. I don't have a coffee table book about Columbus, Ohio. Why? Because if I want to see Columbus, Ohio, I'll get in my car. I'll just drive around 5 minutes from my house. So yeah, La La Land actually works. It does work. It's not the end all be all of cinema, but it's a charming little movie. So I'm going to have to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's real quickly hit Jackie, which came out last week and it's expanding this week. I'm a little late because, like I said, it's a very crowded season and trying to get all these movies in by the end of the year. Natalie Portman plays Jacqueline Kennedy in this disjointed look at her emotional state surrounding the assassination of her husband.
That once there was a fleet.
People like to believe in fairy tales. Don't let it be forgot that for one brief, shining moment, there was a Camelot. There won't be another Camelot. Not another Camelot.
All right, first off, Natalie Portman is getting tons and tons of buzz on this, and people are like, oh, this is going to be her next Oscar. I like Natalie Portman as an actor, so I'm going to compare her to Jessica Chastain, but I kind of feel Natalie Portman's like Dustin Hoffman as an actor. If she's given the right role, she's better, but if she's not given a very good role, she can actually be pretty terrible in it. And I'm not discounting her acting in this movie. I just don't know enough about Jacqueline Kennedy to be able to tell whether she's actually acting or doing a really clever Saturday Night Live impersonation of it. For example, let's take politics. If you were to take Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, I really don't think Alec Baldwin or Kate McKinnon are giving Oscar-worthy performances when they were playing Trump and Clinton during the debates. But they were extremely funny. They're caricatures. And this feels like a caricature. I did not live through the assassination of JFK. It happened almost 10 years before I was born. So I don't know much about Jacqueline Kennedy, and she just does this sort of, this breathy talk. I'm at a loss for whether or not she's doing a good job or just phoning it in. I guess she's doing a good job, but it just, there's something about it that feels insincere. Now, the structure of the movie is very interesting because it's her perspective. It's Jackie's movie, obviously, from the title character. It's her reaction to being right there where her husband gets shot. And it's not just the emotion you feel when the president's shot. It's the emotion you feel when your husband's shot. And it balances that. So it's almost made like almost this weird, kind of like, you know, the last movie Natalie Portman won an Oscar for, which is Black Swan, where it's a sort of this dream logic and sort of not quite real. And you feel like you're disjointed from time itself. But it's the kind of movie that's going to appeal to people who are the history buffs, who love the Kennedy stuff. There's also some great performances by other actors. Peter Sarsgaard plays Bobby Kennedy. He does a great job. He's kind of stand out. And John Carroll Lynch plays LBJ, and he does a great job. It's told very pragmatically and viscerally, and I like that approach to it. Again, I can't say I'm 100% convinced by Portman's performance. And maybe it's just I'm naive in that sense. Maybe I'm just ignorant of Jacqueline Kennedy's persona. There's a scene where she's doing the White House tour that was broadcast. David Brinkley, I think, was interviewing her. And she's very poised and talks like this all the time. But then in scenes where she's doing just herself with her family, she still talks like this. It's like she's sort of this airheadness. It reminds me a little bit of Michelle Williams was in My Week with Marilyn when she played Marilyn Monroe a couple years ago. But still, it's an interesting movie. It's buzzworthy. So I'm going to say that Jackie kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk really quickly about the box office. Last week, I predicted $25 million for Moana, and I said that Incarnate wouldn't even crack five. I was right. It was actually over 25. It was $28 million for Moana, which is a hold for like 50% weekend to weekend. That's not even including the Wednesday opening of Thanksgiving. So that's an incredible hold for Moana. That's very good. And Incarnate barely made it into the top 10 with $2.5 million because it was terrible. This week, I think that Moana is going to hold really well. I think it's going to be $15 million or so, maybe even a little more. And Office Christmas Party is going to come in a close second. The problem with Office Christmas Party is these raunchy R-rated comedies, especially Christmas comedies, don't tend to be huge money makers, and there's so much stuff out there. But I do think it differentiates itself, although it does have some competition from Bad Santa 2, which is going to probably drop out of the top 10 this week. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Last minute Christmas presents, everybody. You can get Jason Bourne or The Secret Life of Pets. That's one of the biggest movies of the year. There's also some smaller stuff out there like Don't Think Twice, which is a nice little movie about improv comedy, and Phantasm Ravager, which I reviewed a couple weeks ago, and of course the remastered version of Phantasm, one of my favorite horror movies from the 70s. There's also a great little show called Lego Star Wars, The Freemaker Adventures, takes place during the original trilogy, and they sort of swerve into it, but it's these characters who are just sort of basically scavengers and salvagers who are trying to make a living in the Empire, and every now and then they swerve into Darth Vader, and every now and then they swerve into, they have the one episode where they go to Cloud City, and they never run into the main people, but they run into, like, Lando Calrissian. Of course, Billy Dee Williams has a voice because he does nothing else nowadays. But that's a fun little movie. I watch it with my kids. My youngest, who's 8, he loves it. He absolutely loves it. I love the Lego Star Wars stuff. I love the Lego stuff. So I think that's going to continue next year with the Batman movie. Anyways, that is it. I need to go for the week. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Rogue One and, of course, Collateral Beauty. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.